Welcome back, the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are cleaning up the discourse streams. We're depolluting. We're pulling out all the plastic and the microfibers of rhetoric out of the public discourse. We'll see. Maybe we're just an invasive species into public discourse, but we're trying. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, stand-up comic, late-night comedy writer, living out here in California, talking to people about rhetoric, trying to give some free education to the world because they certainly want it. They're all thirsty for rhetoric training. On the podcast, we do three things. We talk to comedians about their politics. We interview and convert conservatives because they need help. Surely, come on. Even though they must know they need help. Watch The Daily Show sometime when they're interviewing people at Trump rallies. Tell me they don't need help. And talk to academics and persuasion professionals. We are back this week with another episode of Rhetorician Interviews with Dr. Dave Payne. And we're picking up on the rhetoric of war, which we did part one before. Now we're back because the war is still going on.
Indeed. Turns out
it wasn't a 2-week process. It's been, I think this is week three, right?
So day 19, something like that. Yeah. And not yet over.
Yeah. What's the programming on this? Like,
in fact,
is this
it's
a
getting
limited
more,
6-week
more
series?
Warlike out there in the discourse environment.
It's not clear. Like, is this, what's the arc? Like, is this a mini series or is it a, you know, ongoing series,
well,
dramatic series?
You know, and that's the frustrating or maybe terrifying part of it that, you know, and everybody even sort of meta comments about, we're not sure how, you know, part of the problem here is we're not sure how, what the exit ramp is. Well, how do you wind this down? And at the same time, the rhetoric ratchets up, which makes you less confident that a suitable wind down will be had. So people are, you know, the level of jitteries and sort of aggressiveness about it is, I notice an escalation here.
Well, it's clearly not.
Meanwhile,
there
the
no
media vortex continues to churn up, you know, the tornado here. So.
Right. Well, there is no metas. There are no meta anchors yet. Like, there is no master narrative about this yet. They keep cycling through them, but you can't get one to stick. And I wonder if that's sort of the new process here of in the digital media space, like the transience of meta narratives. Like, they, none of them seem to hold.
Sure. Well, there is that Orwellian, you know, each new iteration sort of reorganizes the past one, so that history is plastic here. So the most recent, now that this QAnon mentality meets war talk, the biolabs, right?
Right.
And so it gloms onto the COVID nonsense. So the biolabs in Ukraine that are now, of course, all military, you know, biochemical weapon labs, which is a distinction that one might not appreciate. I mean, you know, my CVS is probably technically a biolab. and you don't want the germs from there, I'm sure. Nonetheless, not exactly a military installation. So anyway, So that bit of confusion, you know, is now kind of, and then at least some commentator has said this now becomes, you know, sort of stable footing of the reason for the war. So the reasons for the war have been undergoing mutations in relationship to what kind of rhetorical grounding one can get on. And this one seems to be, you know, the Chinese and the alt-right Americans get to jump in on this one. And, it, you know, it makes Tucker Carlson famous again. So anyway, and that kind of crap is, you know, and then what kinds of strategizing gets done in that sort of environment, which is a question that you and I've been struggling with from the beginning. When is the right sort of contextual fodder manufactured to where one could induct one of these hypothetical tactical nuke false flag operations, blah blah blah. That people keep speculating about, you know, and the talk shows and experts continue to sort of set a menu every day that if Putin were really watching, he could take notes on.
Right. Right.
Don't give him any ideas. That's
well, it's a very loose rhetorical environment. That's one of the interesting things you have to watch now about the war. There's so much rhetorical opportunity from so many sources. It's not Cronkite saying, you know, this is Vietnam every night. It's right. Just rhetorically loose. Like it is literally unanchored and unhinged.
Right. But it is this kind of Baudrillardian moment is when does that sort of the need to manufacture the discourse start pulling the reality behind it? So you're starting to see some of the discipline break. Well, why isn't Joe Biden calling up Putin? Well, to say what? I think it's a perfectly good strategy. And Donald Trump saying, well, I would know how to talk to him because we chatted for many hours. Why are we drawing the line here to say we will not invade Ukraine? So people are starting to kind of find porous loopholes in what otherwise has been a pretty, you know, elegant PR management of this thing. I think Biden's done it perfectly right. You come out and you say publicly, we're not negotiating, this is the line, and you know, what else?
Well, I think this sort of new war, you know, the new war techniques, like the economic war that right. we launched on all fronts. Like that was Armageddon, every, you know, weapons pretty much has been launched financially against Russia. At least, again, that's the public talk. So we'll engage this as an economic war.
I think it's wonderful. toward the purification of war, right? That, you know, when it comes right down to money, so.
The purification of war, man, that's in some ways that's what I think Putin's trying to do on his side, right? With historical context of, hey, this has traditionally been great Russia, the Empire of Russia. We're just trying to return it to its purest, you know, its most intentional, what it was supposed to be. The empire is supposed to be there.
And that generates some sympathy among some Americans who really aren't thinking about this. Well, okay, kids, so was Alaska. You know, if we use that criteria, none of these white people should be in America. Period, right?
Well, humans shouldn't be in America. Americans
really are not supposed to be the criterion. I thought we launched on this thing that we were going to allow people to determine that this was the experiment in democracy, people's self-determination. That this was kind of the agenda we were behind. Because if you look at, you know, how and when did all of these boundaries change, there was undoubtedly conflict associated with all of it. So not to mention the fact that was exactly what Hitler kept saying, or Saddam Hussein, or every other historical, you know.
Well, it does go back to purity rhetoric, right? I mean, which has all these strands. It has all these different things, like even achievement and sort of positivity rhetoric is a form of purity rhetoric. Like, be who you're supposed to be, you know, don't be pulled down by the world. Stay true to yourself.
Sure, sure. Well, by purification of war, I did mean something different than what we might talk about as purification rituals, which are indeed governing all of this other stuff, right? You're right about that. That these are,
well, it's once you accept the idea of purity, then you accept the tactics of getting to purity.
Right? Well, and the tropism of the conservative mind is that purity was an Eden that we fell away from. It's always in the past. We were always great back then, and we got to get back to it. And so that whole restoration fantasy, you know, and that's working in American conservatism too. You know, and McLuhan had it right. We're looking in the rearview mirror. They're trying to remember some sort of 50s TV show as the way things were that we need to get back to, not the way we were actually living in the 50s, mind you, right? These myths of origins are, once again, they're updated periodically. So, you know, and that is an easy sell. That is an easy sell. That somehow we've always, you know, it's embedded in Christianity. We fell from grace. But progress turns us around the other direction, has us march toward a different future, right?
But it also has, like on the liberal side, the future is purity, right? Utopia. And if we can just get like Putin and these guys out of the system, then we could all just sort of be decent human beings and just live on the planet in peace.
Right. Well, I've been thinking about Mark Twain because so much of this rhetoric reminds me of his old The War Prayer, which I think everybody ought to go back and read. I hate to mention it because conservatives will probably try to ban it from high school. But what we read in high school, right, just about the drumbeat of war that gets started and when people start, wanting God to work for their side. And, you know, by the way, some people pray that he helps their football team win. But Mark Twain's, I think it was Mark Twain, was it, that we fell from grace and thereby rose above the animals, but was all this falling up. So we're always in that purgatory posture of falling up, right? We fell from grace, but we're rising to redemption. If we can only do the right rituals of purification, that's where you get position.
Right. It was right. Twain. I just looked it up.
And a lot of those times that sorting process of what do we need to do to interrupt this fall and get back on the right side of things has to do with, you know, these easily available hatings or killings, the bloodlettings, these sources of pollution or impurification. So that's why, think about from us in the West, we're listening to this denazification of Ukraine and going, whoa. But that has exactly that kind of, in the mm-hmm. apparently in the Russian narrative, that's why Ukraine got split away, as it was Nazis. The story seeds that are operating over there, we can only hope to catch up on. Yeah. And meanwhile, we're doing ours here.
Sure. I think, one of the things I've talked about a lot on this podcast is how that open slot, that open villain slot, that open pollution slot, anything can be put in there. I mean, the right puts liberals in there. It's just a substitute term for the same rhetoric, but you just need to slide somebody in there and keep them in there. And the liberal is nice because it doesn't have race associated directly with it. You know, it's a vague term, but it's a intense term. So they've just replaced all the more intense terms with liberal. And you're right. When we go across the world over to Ukraine, like people didn't even know where Ukraine was. They didn't know any of the history of Ukraine. There's this flood of information suddenly coming at you about Ukraine that people tend to, instantly try to sort. Like I listened to a guy in the hot tub this week, 70-year-old white dude pontificating in the Manhattan Beach Hermosa 24-hour fitness hot tub about what was really going on in Ukraine. And I'm just sitting there going, and they're just going back and forth, adjudicating each other, like agreeing and agreeing with each other. And I'm like, this is insane what you're doing.
Yeah, that conversation is an interesting one going, how did Putin's talking points get in my hot tub?
It's amazing.
But the other one is the oil prices conversation, which is, a substitute for something. But you're getting the same old, yes, we're insisting that Biden ban Russian oil, but now we're wondering why we don't have our own oil. And, the truth is just so lost in that whole conversation about, America's oil, self-sufficiency. And it's amazing.
Well, and even what I launched the podcast with, which is kind of always, we need better techniques to clean public discourse. That's a purity move, right?
Absolutely. Well, we need good diagnostic. We need to be able to dip, and that's about all you can do, right? Is dip a cup into the lake of discourse and see what kind of contaminants you're seeing floated around in there. That's really what I do when I watch the the cable news, right, or hit a chat room or whatever. Is I'm kind of taking a sample from where did this talk come from, And some of it sort of, you know, it has to glow red or something. These sort of mythic strands that have been around forever, eventually they are thrown into relief.
Well, I think even, you know, the using war backwards as a metaphor for rhetoric and what's going on, this disorganized war of their planes coming from everywhere, there's this coming from here, like nobody knows what's going on. And that kind of is what the rhetoric feels like. So listening to people talk, the little, you know, sort of babble bees or hornets that they've absorbed, these tiny little shards that they can get into their brain and then come out their mouth in a hot tub and, you know, a gym. And I'm like, wow, but you're doing this with an unfiltered, absolutely no conscience about it whatsoever. You feel right. Like, how do people get to that point?
Well, that is the moment. That is the redemption purification moment, right? To talk the talk correctly is itself. And that's why we're willing to elect people who could simply speak it. You don't care if they do it. That itself, that's what you want to get on board of. You know, to actually put these things into practice would be very difficult. So people want to sense that their truth is being told. And how did this get to be the truth is one kind of struggle, but the other, people need certain sorts of patterns. And so I think that's, you know, kind of the educational program. How can we identify? And so, for instance, so much of the content, we're seeing all these smoking apartment buildings, and, you know, how many times have you seen the pregnant lady on the cot in the update? Well, I don't want to be cynical about any of that. Even last night, Lawrence O'Donnell going, and Putin, you know, showing that footage, and Putin kills babies, and repeated it like several times. Well, everybody who's conducted war probably has that credential.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no, what I'm surprised, like, they don't pull up the dogs and the pets.
Right. Well, I've heard talk about dog, you know, the dogs and pets as one. But anyway, I guess with the limited amount of footage that we've seen that's repeated is one thing that, you know, gets my sensors up. And the continuing anecdotal stuff that must come out of Ukraine, but it gets amplified in our media so much. Oh, the Russians are going through houses. They must be starving to death, going through houses looking for food. Well, you know, I mean, sure, there's truth there. The one story that got repeated, they caught one Russian and his meal-ready kit was expired in 2002 or something. So we're going to get...
Right. We're going to win.
It's easy to convince me the Russian military fighting this kind of shabby war with conscripts is probably not up to snuff. They certainly don't spend the kind of money on it that we do. And by some reports, you know, the oligarchs have been stealing from Putin, which is really a rather encouraging bit of news, you know, I think.
If the corruption,
these vehicles have knockoff Chinese Michelins on them. That's why they can't go anywhere. A lot of branding going on here. Anyway.
It's just tsunamis and avalanches hitting at the same time of all this stuff coming at you.
It's the demand for talk. Yeah.
It's insane how much, and I don't access it very much. I don't follow, I for sure don't follow it actively. I'll go on CNN or something in the morning, kind of check in what the major stories are. But I try not to absorb a lot of it because, you know, I there's just no reason to. It's stuff like that. Like, I saw the pregnant lady on the cot, and from a comedy perspective, which you're not allowed to do a lot of,
right.
You know, during the war, like, there's certain rhetorics and certain types of talk which are banned, you know, during the war. But I'm like, well, I guess the Ukrainians aren't that tough. Like, you know, their babies and their moms can't survive a bombing. Look at that. But that kind of, you know, sort of what comedy wants to do with it, would turn it to irony, you know, immediately becomes an immoral act in the context of war. And so, like,
irony is kind of the first, you know, but there is a contraction of meanings. And that is the thing to note, that is what discourse does. And that's how authoritarians, right, that's how it rules. to always create that constant crisis. And for Putin to remain in power, keep in mind he's kept that, you know, that grip on for 20 some years now. You've got to have a free play and an open system for that to take place. But what I was starting to get at is I recognize in this, you know, constant, the enemy is weak, the enemy is incompetent, our boys are great, we are heroic. You know, look at these, you know, Americans going over there. You know, now I wonder about an American who's looking for a war. Quite on, you know, I'm just not automatically going to think this is a completely healthy thing. At any rate, and once again, you have to sort of censor all of those kinds of things. But just the very basic pattern of groupthink, right? What do, right? When we cheer for our team, and this causes us to ignore countervailing information, to censor people with countervailing with information that's critical. Because the effort here is to bolster, and vilification and humiliation of the enemy is like symptom numero uno, right? And to moralize our own position that, and Zelensky's doing that quite well. One can recognize that pattern in this, we collectively perform that. And I suppose that's somewhere in the, you know, the encyclopedia of purification talk. Yeah.
Well, there's also the purifier, right? So Zelensky, you know, is clearly the hero that is emerging out of this, trying to be the savior of Ukraine and, you know, pleading every day with, hey, come on, you know, I need more and more help. And when you look at him, like, to me, like when you look back at traditional American presidents, you know, he's the Teddy Roosevelt.
Our comedian. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and he's a comedian. So he's an actor. So he knows how to play it. But it's the opposite side of the coin of Putin being with shirtless on a horse. Right. Zelensky's showing bravery under fire and is in a T-shirt and talking plain speak. You know, all the things that Americans typically, you know, if you look in the past, especially like in a leader. And it's the same kind of stuff that you want to dump onto Trump, that he's plain speak. He's just like us. He's raw. You know, right. And you're like, what? We really want that trope.
It is the swagger. And this is one thing I'm noticing in the discourse and what, you know, that everybody can agree so much with what Biden's doing. The policies, you know, pretty much are hitting the right stride and stroke. But his popularity isn't going up that much. And I think part of it is that craving for the swagger and that need for it is so great. We're willing to hire this clown to pretend he's got it, although all evidence of the contrary, you know, and Trump is out there making all the right tough talk, and Biden's just too old, he can't sell it, you know.
Well, he's old, he's fragile, he can't really get up there and be, you know, his right. Son, Beau Biden, was groomed clearly for this moment. You know, had been in the military, right, was right, a prosecutor, right. Had been, you know, all this
it's
stuff.
True.
And you're
it's
like,
true. It's true.
Where's that guy? And he even said it, like Biden said it when he was, once he got elected, he's like, yeah, it's great to be here. When he was at Delaware the day of the inauguration, he's like, it's great to be here. But this should be my son. Like, he literally came out and said that.
Right. But, you know, back in the olden days, we saw Biden as a fairly weak and unintellectual liberal, you know, very much middle of the road. But he's shown to be pretty smart in all of this, I think. And when he speaks, I just would like the rest of the world to be educated enough to think that's good. We got a great team here of really smart people running stuff. I don't need somebody to come out there and beat their chest, but it's once again, it's back to the almost instinctive need for those kinds of things. But back to Zelensky, as the modern Churchill or whatever, and you're talking about the purifiers. He's scheduled to speak today or this week with Congress. That's an interesting discourse event for an old rhetorician. How do you get there? And you know. It's having an impact, and in a way, it is kind of in running Biden. to some extent, I think.
Well, he's definitely absorbing what Biden could get as, the hero, war hero cred. I mean, Biden's right. Clearly has always been a behind the, walls negotiator, but we don't celebrate that as an American hero.
Right.
Like, you point to me like the great American negotiator. Where's that been? Yeah. Like,
well,
Trump tries to claim it with art of the deal sometimes, but that's just aggressive. I cheated people, and got away with it.
Yeah, for at least 10 days, my line has been, be wary of the person from either party who steps forward here to capitalize on this cachet. That does concern me.
Well, and I've seen this now with the right over the last few years after January 6th and all the things that have happened. Like, they haven't had somebody, DeSantis, Hawley, Cruz, these guys, they all keep trying to step up and take the mantle away from Trump. And nobody is getting there, it seems to me. Like, nobody, Cotton, none of these people have actually gotten out in front of it to where they look like they can handle the tides coming at them the way that Trump did. So in some ways, I think on the liberal left, like, I think the extreme progressive liberals always like, well, we want AOC, Stacey Adams, all these kind of people, like a much more aggressive progressive. And Biden is too moderate to be a hero for them.
Right. But, most people don't watch cable news and most people don't have that much allegiance to these parties and these factions of parties. I think, it's very difficult for a politician to, that's just part of the monomythic hero business of Trump is coming from the outside with absolutely no knowledge and background or allegiance in a way.
Well, he was a blank slate. He was a blank purifier at that point.
We could override onto him anything we wanted.
Yeah, and even his inaugural address basically was a purification address. We're going to get back to America, these enemies, NATO, all these things that have polluted us. He created new pollutants. And that's what his thing was.
He mouthed what a certain segment of the population had been repeating over and over and over again. He simply gave it, body and voice. He didn't create much at all, as far as I can tell. All that talk was around. We just hadn't given it, it just had been marginalized. And that was kind of the rupture that writing that, however thin that surf was, however accidental that may have been. No, to me, and I probably used this before, but Chauncey Gardner from being there is really that people just, here's this complete blank slate that people overwrite their own agendas onto. And I think that's pretty much what's going on there.
Well, and speaking of blank slates, did you see the footage of the woman in Red Square who got arrested for holding up a blank sign?
Yes.
I'm like, that's a rhetorical moment. That's a simulacrum moment
I loved it. Absolutely. And now, for a whole crowd to stand up with a blank sign would be almost.
We are all Spartacus with a blank sign.
Maybe we could borrow that here. Just.
I'm sure we will. I mean, just the gesture towards protest, right? Just anything that breaks the seamlessness of the authoritarian story, like any symbol that even, gets near adding in a little bit of complication to it, it has to be taken out.
I love it. Just sort of a moo response. Right?
Well, you saw this, I think, too, with the Trump rallies and things like that. They can't absorb hecklers. They can't have anything coming in from the outside. Like, when he did have to purify his rallies, he did it with too much vehemence, like, making fun of the disabled guy and, calling for violence against somebody who was heckling. And that's too real for people. Like, when it goes into that, the whole thing about that rhetoric is that it has no bodies on the ground. When you start to see violence, then it starts to rip the seams on that narrative structure. And so they've been very, good about not letting violence into those stories.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that, I guess, maybe speaks to framing that, once again, as long as this occurs, and, you know, we have plenty of violence within the proscenium of the TV screen. And but when it ruptures that frame.
Well, that's how we assign, that's one of our major ways of assigning a villain, right? It's like they are responsible for violence against people. Remember the old guy who got knocked down by the thugs, you know, started bleeding from the ear, you know, during one of the protests, one of the BLM protests. And because he was such a frail old white dude, you know, it was really hard video to watch. But if we can assign those type of violent villains and make it stick, that's one of the things I think that actually brings people crashing down. And Trump avoided it. You know, he's always really good at going up to the edge. Like, he never says the words that would actually get him labeled as a racist or, you know, all these things that you would expect him to not have the discipline to have. But I guess 40 years of training of, hey, just don't use the word, use everything but the actual word and you'll be okay. You know, that kind of discipline from an actor is what you need. Because you can't push him in. You can't push him into the Few Good Men moment where he shouts, "You can't handle the fact that I," you know.
Well, he does seem to know where that edge is. I mean, you know, an example would be calling the COVID the Chinese virus, or pronouncing with some relish the Wuhan. I mean, he learns how to speak in that code.
Yeah.
But others are hearing in that. And I have to think there was a sizable part of his constituency that liked the violence, that those guys, you know, sure, beating on their heads is really what we need here. They certainly were threatening in those. So they're not abhorring the violence at all. And they want some. They want more of that. They want more of this tough guy stuff.
Well, I think they do. It's just that's, to me, when I look back at the things that were the inroads that allow us to pull down Nazism and, you know, all these different things and make them full villains is death. You know, you can't talk about the Nazis without pulling up the prison camps and all that footage. They showed that to my daughter, I think it was fifth grade, you know, and she was not ready at all for Holocaust imagery. And they're right. Like, well, you know, that really happened. I'm like, well, lots of things really happened in the world. But because we got footage of this one and you want to make sure she knows that the Nazis were evil, you hit her with death images that she's never even come close to seeing in the world. And, you know, as a rhetorical practice to make sure everybody knows that the Nazis were evil, I get it, you know, but now like that, I think that's what the authoritarians learned is avoid that dramatic death imagery and we can get away with almost anything.
Well, it certainly does, you know, and I think that's explains a great deal of the imagery we've been seeing is that, that, you know, why we saw the pregnant lady maybe 15, 16 times in a single day of broadcasting and, you know, that, and why these numbers of how many have been killed or the bombing, you know, I'm clearly, you know, who knows how errant the bomb was that blew up in front of the maternity hospital. You know, they said it looked like one of these kind of bunker buster style, you know, just a huge crater, I guess, that, you know, I'm not trying to apologize for it. It's just that the use of that footage was sure, you know, was constant, just the horrifying, terrifying element has been, I think.
But it's still implied, like you're not watching body parts, are you? Like, you're not seeing.
Well, we did see on one, you know, like a whole family that had been killed by a bomb just laying out there. And that was to me, you know, but anyway, it does explain a great deal of this emotional response and to have that immediate footage there.
But we're still sanitizing the war.
Absolutely. And, you know, and once again, the talk or the interpretation that comes around all of this. How messaging intervenes with that kind of stuff to once again to villainize and ridicule the enemy to bolster our own sense of morality and superiority and the inevitability of victory. All of this talk is getting made for you. If you listen long enough, it's coming out of a lot of mouths. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of a rhetorical guidance, and Zelensky is. he is probably the main fount of that.
What is the role of the rhetorician in war? Because instantly it becomes one of these locations that everybody wants to control. Like, what is the rhetoric that's going to dominate? Is it going to be, you know, if we let Putin, like there was a thing on CNN, I saw, was it yesterday, where a woman ran onto a newscast in Russia and held up a sign, "You're being lied to." You know, anything to break their rhetorical frame.
Well, I think, we need an army of technicians that are able to do that. I trust, you know, our media savvy kids and hackers, and, you know, the posting of messages in Yelp reviews of restaurants. This is a good restaurant, but your country is, you know, invading another country, and I'm not going to, you know, product reviews and things like that. I think that's fabulous stuff that somehow, how do you get the message? Unfortunately, I guess the urban technic-savvy Russians are able to get that, but that by and large, the rural populations, not so much. It's going to be very hard to get to.
So you have the same process.
But so anyway, I think that kind of informational assault has got to be as important as the economic sanctions, because you've got to explain those sanctions to them. And probably by and large, Putin is maybe even winning that war within his own confines. So these are nasty Westerners. I talked with somebody who had posted to the Chinese audience about sanctions. Well, we live with your USA sanctions. Why do you have the right to sanction people? You know, this isn't an automatically a purified form of war. This is another form of arrogance and domination from the West. So it's not a universal sell. That's by any means.
Well, so we look at this idea of the rhetoric war that's going on, and it's the same process coming from completely different angles. So over here, you have Putin and the propagandistic frame, and the good people, the truth, are trying to break in there to affect, you know, change and get a message to the audience. And over here in our world, it's like, oh, this is a democracy, but the propagandists are breaking in and dropping in conspiracy and falsehood and everything else to complicate our frame. So you have these massively complicated frames right now, and you see the rhetoric war going on about circling and trying to keep everybody from, you know, breaking into the propaganda frame, versus over here, where I guess because we've got the First Amendment, which is a wide open door for people to just dump, you know, whatever toxic radiation that they want into our discourse. It's like, well, all right, then what do we do about that situation?
Well, that's true. We haven't tried to conduct our own, you know, propaganda control in this sort of environment. But, you know, back to your question, what's the role of the rhetorician? You know, you said the comedian can't do certain things. And I suppose some of us, like myself, fall along closer to that line than working for the state to help craft messages. At some point, you know, I suppose, you know, it's like a Donald Duck selling war bonds, or Disney making tapes about keeping your mouth shut about military secrets and things like that. But at some point, you got to work for the right cause, and that's a moral decision too. So message crafting has got to go on for, you know, if you believe you're on the right side of history. And I think, you know, I think we are in the right. I don't want to say anything that actually tries to undermine that. But at the same time, I can't help but feel like, you know, that is the, you know, the spectacle of war. For sane people, when this kind of talk starts getting made, and you can see that arc happening where America could be seduced into this war. And there will be competing claims about who started it. To a certain point, when you're in it, it won't matter. The only thing that matters is not getting killed and winning. I feel like we're being, groupthink is getting us to that doorstep. One has to, you know, hope that wiser heads prevail.
Wiser heads, find those for me. I posted a thing last week about just go back and reimagine all of World War II, but at the very beginning of it, give Hitler nuclear weapons. Figure out how does that war play out? I mean, the only saving grace under that scenario, I assume, is that the generals underneath this psychopath kill him before he can launch the nuclear weapons.
You're rewriting history with the Putin narrative.
Right. But I mean, how do you, once you,
who would have, how are we dropped the atom bomb? I mean, who would have? Just to save the motherland? I mean, there was a race, you know, apparently, if all the old movies are correct, there was a race on to, that was a joke when I was a kid in the 50s. That was a joke of the reason why we are winning the space race is because our German scientists are better than the Russians' German scientists, right?
Yeah, right. It's just such a, that's a
and so new, and ours were, you know, they didn't tell it as Jewish scientists, but a lot of that was a fact, right?
Well, we had in the 70s and stuff, like with movie War Games and things like that, we had the whole nuclear stories, right? There's the nuclear winter, and we had all those nuclear stories, and they went away over the last 15 or 20 years. We haven't seen that many of those war stories where, oh yeah, the upper end of this war, hey man, it's the annihilation of the planet, you know? And I grew up underneath that, and that was always sort of in the air as a dominant narrative, especially about Russian America. But now with the proliferation of this stuff, it's like, well, what if Ukraine had nuclear weapons? Would Putin have walked in there?
Well, that's certainly, you know, that's certainly a conversation, because the Ukraine gave up their nukes as part of the dismantling of the Soviet empire. And we talked them into it. So we gave them assurances at that time about their autonomy. And indeed, I'm not the historian to say, but at least I've read that Putin signed on to all of that to guarantee their autonomy that he's now welching on. So there's a lot of history going on here. But absolutely. But, you know, the nuclear thing, my wife came in after listening to NPR yesterday. I don't know what she did, but well, now I'm being told that I have to worry about nuclear war.
It's starting to bubble up.
That stuff's happening.
Yeah,
I started trying to Google when Putin developed the hypersonic, what he, you know, here 3 or 4 years ago, right? I think 2018, as far as I can tell, he claimed that Russia had developed hypersonic nuclear missile deliveries that could not be stopped by anything that we had. And he made a little video. And what I noticed about that video was the arrow landed right at my house. Basically,
all to take out David Payne.
Well, I assumed at the time it was Central Command in Tampa, but others have been speculating lately it was Mar-a-Lago, which I'm not sure I believe yet. So I started trying to find this to decide whether or not that video is not available. It, there's a slot for it that says this is no longer available in your country. However, there's all kinds of videos of in the last 3 weeks. Putin sending on firing these hypersonic missiles that he's airing. And we're getting absolutely no reportage of that. As far as I know, I haven't heard anybody mention that, you know, as a threat 3 weeks ago, Putin shot off one of these missiles. So
that narrative's coming. You can feel it. It's starting to percolate up as it's going to be one of the dominant narratives about why we can't fight Ukraine and you know, we can't fight Russia actively and all these things. But now Russia's starting to expand what it considers to be aggression. Like, you know, it's starting to label countries as being aggressive for doing economic war and, you know, that kind of stuff. Going to make it there?
Did
Putin land a hypersonic into your trachea? But it's gotten to be the point where, you know, when you look at what are the dominant narratives going to be, and is it this idea that we are a democracy and Ukraine is a democracy, and ergo, even though there are bad outcomes across the board, we have to follow that narrative. So is it going to be the democracy narrative? Is it going to be the avoid nuclear war narrative? Like, what is going to become the mega narrative here? Because it's still clearly not determined.
No. Can you cut the audio off?
Yeah, well, it's here. I'll just pause. All right, so Dave Payne survived his attack from oak pollen. And so we're going to dive back into rhetoric here on and war, since he just went to war with an invasive vegan.
I'm sure there's a metaphor in there somewhere. Right. What were we talking about? The nuclear.
We're just talking about which narrative is going to end up dominating, because clearly whatever becomes the mega narrative about, oh, it's another Hitler, we've got to stop him. So there's the appeasement narrative that's going on. There's the nuclear narrative. There's a, you know, saving democracy across Europe narrative. And you're starting to see these fight it out at a mega level.
And the, well, we have nukes too narrative, right? Which, why should we be, and that even surfaces over in the Trump camp as well. Hey, he's crazy enough that Putin wouldn't believe that he would retaliate. So who knows?
Yeah,
I think that's the next phase of this thing. And certainly whether they're baiting that one way or the other, whether that's something that ultimately sets the bait for Putin to, why not? You know, if he's really losing, it has no.
Well, and right now, this is still an abstract war. It's not affecting America directly. Like, we're sanctioning, but we're not being sanctioned. Like, it's not destroying our economy. There's no blowback yet. So we are at active war through a proxy, you know, of the Ukraine, but we're not yet getting hit.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, there's frames that floating around there that automatically, if we do this, like the no-fly thing, we're struggling for these boundaries, right? And well, that's automatically World War III. Well, is it? What does it have in common with World War III? You know, they really do need to continue to, and I think through the United Nations is one of the best ways to do this. This is the entire world against, right, what's going on there. And just, you know, and keep that pressure on. But this is the entire world.
Which is another mega narrative. It's clearly not. China is 1 billion people, and they're not, like, I haven't heard anything about India. What does India think about all this? That's another 1 billion people.
They've not been very cooperative with our propaganda efforts at all. And one wonders why, because, you know, they're not usually on the side of China either. But
so at least almost 50% of the planet is not going along with these sanctions and, hey, let's stop Putin. They're like,
Well, yeah, China is doing what, in my understanding, they typically do, which is to play their cards very slowly and keep them very close to their chest, right? And not really taking sides. Their ambassador to the UN gave a very neutral sort of speech about staying, you know, We don't observing sovereignty of nations and things like that. That could be read both ways. But it's back.
Oh, you're choking again? All right, I'll hit pause and we'll let you work it out. All right. We're still trying to make sure Dave Payne survives his biological attack. Well, that's the other thing. Chemical weapons are in the story ether. Like, if
biological
that happens,
and chemical, yes.
That's how they got into Iraq, right? Was the Kurds and Saddam Hussein.
Right. 12 years previous. Yeah. This was part of the hermeneutics of evil that made us sure that we need to invade Iraq.
Well, in those story resources, I think that's a really good way of looking at the hermeneutics within the story of how you make a villain. And at a certain level, like, the villain reaches a toxicity where everybody's like, okay, yeah, we got to stop this, you know, and they're trying to do that with Putin. I'm not saying, like, again, I think rhetoric has this weird moral space during war that even if you're doing analysis and you're being critical, like the way good academics and intellectuals are, it's like, well, you're still doing damage to our narrative, you know, that's trying to get people motivated and rah-rah behind war. Well, that may be true, but, you know, if we don't do that, then we allow it to cycle up to the other side of the pendulum of, hey, the military can say whatever it wants, do whatever it wants. And we don't like that in this country. So over here, you got the peace, you know, protest rhetoric about let's see everything they're doing and we'll make decisions. Over here, it's military's like, you don't need to see anything we're doing. Well, just trust us. The chemical weapons are definitely, you've seen it in the last couple of weeks. They've been floating this one up in.
Yeah, as another, you know, possibility. And I guess that, you know, that became the standard interpretation when Putin would say he's worried about biological and chemical weapons from you know, the West or from Ukraine or from, you know, the NATO in Ukraine, whatever, that this is a way of him telegraphing his own intentions, because creating that kind of confusion is out of his playbook, right?
Yeah, preemptive defense, which is our, you know, again, people have tried to drag Desert Storm in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan over into this war and use it as a metaphor source of, hey, we did all this, you know, back in a sovereign nation and all that. And we're like, well, we were justified. So again, you start to see the rationales and the motives sort of play out in this sort of back and forth. How do we end up settling on one of these things? Because it seems like we always end up settling on like a dominant motive. And
what do you mean by we?
Good point. I guess the culture.
You know, it seems to me, you know, when you say what does the rhetoric do, I guess I for me, you know, but I'm not working for the State Department to do their messaging. Although somebody could be. For me, I basically, my approach as an educator and a critic is I want to make people aware and give them the equipment they need to make good moral as well as practical choices, right? So I want people to be aware of their own position in this, even though, once again, that can escalate to where you don't have that kind of control. But we don't just have to mindlessly follow it around. And I think historical precedents, like, you know, comparing this to, you know, what we did in invading Iraq, is there are differences, but there are also similarities in terms of the viewpoint of the world. And there are also consequences that, as far as I'm concerned, at least, I think politically and economically, the Iraqi conflict was the beginning of our modern troubles and weaknesses. Indeed, as people are projecting, this will destroy Russia too.
And I think, you know, Biden, again, not sure what level chess Biden is playing with his public discourse, but one of his first statements was, we're not trying to destabilize Russia. It's like, well, I don't know about that. Maybe you were just suggesting in a reverse psychology, why don't we destabilize Russia?
Well, because, you know, what's Russia? Well, we are certainly trying to destabilize the Putin narrative that is dominating Russia. So if he sees himself as Russia, as most emperors would, then yeah, from our own democratic point of view, no, we're not really trying to make Russia bankrupt, you know, in terms of the people or their modern progress or in any way, shape or form. I don't think. I don't think that is the goal here. I think we're trying to make them not want to commit this war, and maybe stay out of our elections in the future. So,
well, that's a good question too. Sort of, what's this war going to do to affect the next presidential election? Like, if they can meld, you know, Trump and Putin together, and they've never been able to hold that, you know, tightly enough. He wiggles away from it. But if you can say, hey, look what autocrats do, look what authoritarianism is, vote against it. And that's essentially, you know, before it was just Trump, like he was so vile in so many different ways for the liberal left, that I think that was a great way of getting people out to vote. But now maybe it's, you know, attaching him into this Mussolini light, kind of the, you know, guy wants to be Putin. Do you want that in America? Like, maybe that's becomes a...
Yeah, I have to think in the great, you know, applause meter here that Trump dims and democracy brightens. And But you know, elections are big confusing things, and people can rationalize almost anything. And there's certainly a stripe and rank of Trump voter who thinks he's exactly the right guy to be standing up to Putin at this point in time. And then there's another stripe and rank of them that thinks that's what we liked about Trump, is he'd be joining Putin, or he would have already gotten rid of NATO. So, yeah, it's what narrative is really sort of standing on election night, the eve of election, that really controlled it. And who else is in the mix? I think, you know, given our diversity and our dualities and all of that, the kind of the lesson from our previous elections is no one party dominates, no one set of policy issues really will, you know, yield good sense or you know, consensus. And so it is kind of, you know, there is something pretty democratic about all of that. I mean, democracy is a really messy thing. It is a hugely messy thing.
Well, I think there's an organically messy democracy, and then there's an artificially made messy democracy, which I think is what the right has done. It's like, we need chaos here, because story cuts through chaos, and we've got the best, you know, dystopian story about the other side.
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm all for the elevation of the species and for the emergence of educated, rational discourse and truth in, you know, institutions and journalism and all of those things that dominated the 20th century from about, you know, the 1920s on. But let's be mindful that we survived, oddly enough, and muddled through long before that with no better equipment and intelligence than we have now. Now, mind you, it did get us into, you know, two world wars, but.
Well, and I mean, it becomes a world war because of technology, right? Because you can.
And the cost of that may be much greater now.
Yeah, you can wage war at that scale with these type of machines.
So. And at the same time, rhetorically, there may be larger frames out there. Like, if you're such a great leader, Putin, why aren't you kind of helping us with climate change instead of, you know, weaning us off of fossil fuel rather than blowing up our ordnance in your neighboring country? Where's this kind of leader? I mean, there could be a reemergence of a greater world consciousness here. And I'm very encouraged, you know, to learn in any of this that around the world and in America and in Russia herself, that there are those enlightened, forward-looking young people who are willing to say, yeah, we're just not going to do business with you. We're not going to play by old rules. And, you know, we're going to shame you. So I think that's a strong move, if not for this war, then for the next one. And
isn't part of the problem with the youth is that, you know, they haven't been bought off yet. And then they get a little older and they get bought off. And then you get a new crop of the youth who's like, you know, morality, until they get in there and they get bought off. And, you know, then they got property to.
Well, we need more people sort of articulating the narrative that there is progress. I have to think there has been some. I mean, there is good news in a lot of these things. I do think that, you know, certainly media, as we've talked about on many occasions, has made it messy and made things difficult, that to not be ruled by elites in many ways, and not to not be alienated from the means of production of media myths has come at a certain price of order. And yet at the same time, I do think people are in general more aware, and that, you know, it has been difficult. So I do think that what's gone on in the United States in the last 5 years has been pretty anomalous. I think a lot of it is very reactionary, and a lot of it is very generational. You know, some of these people, you can't change their minds. You're just going to have to outlive them, right?
Well, and that's a good.
That is the goal, after all.
Sure. this idea of new world versus old world, like the old world is going through its death throes. And this is another example of it, of guys like Putin, you know, old white guy who just cannot give up the old world techniques of power. And, you know, I'm going to take this whether I deserve it or not. I don't care what it causes, you know, havoc in the world. And I mean, if you can fight that sort of old world, I mean, the right wants to make that traditional and like sort of, like you said, go back to this mythic state. The left wants to make that problematic. And it's like, no, that's where we had all our, you know, problems that keep us from moving forward and becoming a, you know, rational, peaceful species across the board. And so I think this new world versus old world, I've used that rhetoric before talking about the right and the left.
Well, that's why I say I think there may be larger frames and rhetorically we ought to be giving voice to them. I'm sort of saying, you know, one way to read this, Vlad, is that the rest of the world doesn't really want the Soviet Empire back. So cut that shit out. Right. This ain't going to happen. Now where's the line? Right, to start to redrawing the risk board from a whole different vantage point. The rest of us would like to see the planet survive this particular phase of, greenhouse gases. Now, where's the line? So that there, you know, if we could get build consensus, and so it is a question of leadership, and it is a question of, like we've observed many things, that we tend to regress towards these instinctive brainstem kinds of solutions because they do build easy consensus. And there's no doubt that diversity and pluralism and all those things that we value make governorship very difficult. Democracy is a fragile, difficult thing.
Yeah. Again, when all the doors are open, people of all ilk pour through.
And as long as they aren't causing any trouble, we let that go on, right? Freedom is also an expensive sort of crime. I mean, you know, if you were totally wise and smelling the bacon and had a measure of control when all this QAnon crap got started, how would you have squashed it, right? Rather than just letting it sort of fester there as a, you know, we tend not to be good at anticipating these things. But who would know when they started Facebook and it was just a way for, you know, kids to party and older people to find out what their high school friends had for lunch. Who knew?
Right. Yeah. Well, we're always reacting to change. We're not engineering change. This idea of, you know, engineering change across millions and billions of people, kind of insane. You know, I think that in some ways, you know, Trump or Putin is trying to engineer change. This idea that I have a mechanism for creating something in the world that I want to happen. I don't care whether it's moral, you know?
Well, but there is that conservative impulse. So it is very puritanical. We just won't do that kind of stuff, right? No dancing.
Right. Well, cool. All right. We're going to let you off.
Recuperate. I'm sorry for the coughing.
No, it's like I said, this is very low level production bar. So coughs and normal human things are acceptable. They don't get edited out and make us seem like superhuman communicators, which is the media's thing.
Oak pollen will bring down the best of us.
Yes. Just dump a bunch of pollen on Russia and let them sneeze their way, you know, back into their
side. Well, hopefully by next time it will go away. Otherwise, I'll take a Zyrtec and we'll get through it.
All right. Well, sounds good. Thanks for jumping on. We will come back and we'll talk some more about this stuff because it's endless. Clearly, there are rhetorical missiles and bombs dropping everywhere, and we're just, you know, trying to figure out.
So far, it is endless.
Like, what can we do? And rhetoricians have a role to play. So, get out there, do some persuasion, talk about this stuff. As always, the world needs it. We'll see you next time.